Hello and welcome to a special episode of Global Roaming, where we're covering all the extraordinary events that have unfolded in the Gulf countries over the weekend.
Well, after weeks of anticipation, both the United States and Israel have launched attacks on Iran. There were multiple missiles sent toward locations all across the country. Iran responded quickly, targeting Gulf states, particularly U.S. Installations and bases in the Gulf states. Now, the very latest that we're hearing is that Donald Trump is saying that Iran's supreme leader is dead, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. So much to discuss. Yes. Geraldine, let's start. Hamish, you're listening in too, but Geraldine, let's start with you. What was your reaction when you realised that this was happening?
Well, look, I suppose what I'm left with, because I did realise last night and I watched as comprehensively as I could, I think the question that is on my mind now is, who is running Iran right now? I think this is a very, very big issue. The there is a list, a positive list of about sort of key, about eight, let alone the supreme leader, about eight key people, the head of defence, the head of the Navy, the head of their intelligence service, I think the head of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, who are all said to be dead. This is the IDF, the Israeli Defence Force, is saying this. And so you do wonder that who is there to run the place at the moment. Now, that is clearly that the purpose was regime change, as we heard in that truly remarkable press statement that President Trump made last night. And there are pictures emerging. I was waylaid by the man at the front desk of the ABC, who was Iranian, saying, "This is the best day of my life," showing me all the pictures coming from his friends and family of extraordinary sort of celebrations, almost like the liberation of Paris, if you know what I mean. But there's so much we don't yet know. That's what I am perplexed by. Who is running the place? There must absolutely not be a risk of it settling into what happened to Iraq after the Iraqi regime of Saddam Hussein fell. How are you seeing it, Hamish?
Look, I think there's a lot of immediate questions that flow from the one that you've just posed, Geraldine, because if the purpose is regime change, but all you've done is kill the supreme leader, and the Council of Experts gathers, you know, this body of clerics that originally chose this supreme leader and then promptly appoints another one, then what have you actually achieved by doing this? This is such an extraordinary thing for the Trump administration, which, you know, has promised voters in the United States again and again and again that it wouldn't wage new frontier wars in the Middle East, in fact, anywhere in the world. And this is now Trump's seventh international intervention as president. I saw that figure being used today. And by far, from all of the interventions that he's made, I think this is probably the most dangerous. We've talked about Venezuela in the past, the decapitation of the Maduro regime. Iran is altogether a more complicated kettle of fish, as it were. And you've seen, you know, this explode out into the rest of the region, you know, with hotels in Dubai being evacuated, airports in other parts of the Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, through which so much of the world's resources passage being shut down.
Yes, we'll know it when we go to the petrol pump and that there is a war.
But also when we pay our insurance premiums, because I think they've cut insurance offerings to goods travelling through those waterways at the moment already. The thing that stands out for me is that it was only a few months ago that Trump said that the United States and Israel had obliterated Iran's nuclear power or Iran's nuclear production facilities, its program. And yet here we are with no clear reasoning or rationale around the timing of this from the Trump administration, no specific stated objective beyond the nuclear issue and the leadership of the country. Why, if you'd obliterated the nuclear program,
do you have to go back in and get it?
Are you doing this now?
Yes.
I'm intrigued by this language around it being a preemptive war, which is a term that both the Israelis and the Americans have used. And you have to ask, preemptive of what? Of the Iranians getting a nuclear weapon. And as you say, that kind of contradicts what we thought happened a few months ago. Is this, in fact, a war of choice? And I think that's the conversation that we've seen played out in the UN Security Council at the moment. Donald Trump is very insistent that it was the Americans who were under direct threat from Iran, and that's what caused his action. That's what prompted his action. But then we're hearing from lots of people in the US Congress, including Tim Kaine, who we had on the show a few weeks ago, saying, look, he needed to come to us to make sure that we backed him on this. This should have come before Congress. This yes. isn't a war of self-defence. This is a war of choice. And I think we're hearing the same thing from the UN Security Council. Remember Iraq. Remember Iraq. Remember the debate that went, you know, Colin Powell persuading the UN Security Council that there was a reason to do this. Congressional debates about there needing to be a reason to do this. And Trump has really acted completely on his own here.
I think the other description I've seen already, Kylie, is war of opportunity. So Trump and the administration spotting an opportunity in this current context with the Iranian regime looking probably weaker than it has done at any previous point since this particular Ayatollah has been in charge. Remember, you know, he's been there since the late 80s. He was the deputy defense minister initially after the revolution took place, and then actually was not the favored candidate to become the supreme leader. He didn't actually have the religious training to take up that position. They had to sort of change the description of who could be appointed in order to give him that pathway. But he's ruled with an iron fist, and obviously his background in developing the Iranian Revolutionary Guards has played such a key feature in the way that he's led the country. But I think, you know, you see protests on the streets. You see the, you know, the genuine change to the military geopolitics of that region in the aftermath of the 12-day war last year. Iran looked weak. It was unable to respond in any meaningful way. On top of that, you have all of Iran's proxy actors in the region weakened, from Hezbollah to the Houthis in Yemen, to the situation in Iraq, which has transformed so radically in recent years. So I think it's not just about a war of choice for Trump. It's spotting a moment of opportunity. And, of course, an ailing, sickly leader in his late 80s with no clear plan for succession.
I think it was the Israelis spotting a moment that they couldn't pass up. I think that's the crucial thing. And, you know, it makes that visit of Benjamin Netanyahu, what was it, 8-9 days ago to Washington, very, very significant visit. And my suspicion is the Israelis thought, we will never have a better chance than this. We've got this mercurial president, capricious man. We've got the Iranians on the back foot. They've clearly obliterated their air force. That has happened before. You've got an extremely unhappy Iranian population. We won't have a better time than this. And I suspect they've really semi-forced Trump. Clearly, Trump was terribly ambivalent about this. You could just feel it. And, you know, yesterday when he made his decision finally, and they were genuinely locked and loaded, you know. Actually, John Bolton, whom we've had on the show, wrote a very good piece during the week, which was reprinted, saying, there is no better planner of war than the American military. Doesn't mean they carry it out necessarily ideally once they're in it. So they were planned down to the last, you know, last bit of bullet, as it were, and they just went straight away. Now, I think, to me, the question is, I have thought for a long time, and I've said to you, Kylie, that I think the Israelis have penetrated that country extraordinarily well, you know, quotes well. And
which
they
country
would,
do you mean? The United States Iran, or Iran?
Iran. And they will know exactly what all the different leading people in the Revolutionary Guard, how they feel, how they behaved. I'm sure they've been trying to turn some of them to actually, and in a way, you could make the argument that it would be a patriotic decision for one of them to put their hand up in this moment of chaos. They're very good at re-establishing chains of command, by the way, the Iranians. They're very structured to withstand leadership assassination. They're very big students of history. But someone's got to put their hand up and say, we are now in charge. Now, I will bet that the Israelis have been in there big time for many, many months trying to work on people and say, now is your moment. That's what I'm watching for, is what the Revolutionary Guards now do. I think that's the crucial question.
I think as much as I'm watching for that, I'm definitely watching for the response from the Iranian people, right? Because this is the thing that gets Trump over the line. If this is Trump's project, if his aim is regime change, that can't happen without the Iranian people coming onto the streets, as he's implored them to do, as Benjamin Netanyahu has implored them to do. And I would say in that context, because I think that's so critical an element to this turning out successfully for President Trump, these announcements of all these senior Iranian officials being killed, and that's very helpful in terms of having a psychological impact that might encourage the Iranian people onto the streets. So,
but there's no organised opposition. That's the trouble. Even if they come onto the streets, what do they do then?
But even, but even the CIA assessment, you know, in the weeks leading up to the war, was that if the Supreme Leader was removed, he would probably be replaced by a hardline figure at the IRGC.
Yeah,
so if that is the case, this is enormously risky. This is, I mean, the
it's
chances.
Not the mullahs. That's the crucial thing. It's not the mullahs.
Well, but is that okay with the Iranian people?
Oh, like, it might well be because they don't want chaos.
Can I just share with you that this is a comment from an Iranian citizen, quoted by an Iranian expert who's in contact with people. Of course, it's very hard. Again, we're talking about the fact that there's this internet shutdown and almost impossible. Now, whether it's a shutdown that the government has chosen or whether they've knocked out, who knows what the explanation for that is, although we did know what the explanation was for it last time around. Here is someone saying that they are terrified of regime collapse because of the outcomes that they've seen in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, in Afghanistan. They don't trust the US or Israel. And I know this is just one opinion, but it's worth sharing. And this Iranian man wrote, "A bad government is survivable. No government is not."
That's my point. That's why I think they've got to, whoever it is, they've got to have somebody who has got governance experience and, quite frankly, probably will have to be a bit of a strong man for a while, just so that the place doesn't disintegrate. And that's what I suspect a lot of the work has gone on to working out who that might be. It's incredible. Imagine the conversations happening inside that a Revolutionary Guards Corps and in their families. I mean, the risk of putting your hand up. You know, if you just think back to what used to happen to people, you know, in the Wehrmacht, the quotes, the good people from the Wehrmacht trying to overthrow Hitler, and what happened there. Usually you ended up at the end of a rope. Mm. Now, so somebody is thinking like that right now as we're speaking. I mean, the drama inside that country must be extraordinary.
And of course you have Reza Pahlavi, the son of the ousted Shah who has lived most of his life overseas. He's doing that, right? He's putting his hand up. The only real indication of any support for him inside Iran is that his name was chanted on the streets during some of those recent protests. But it wouldn't seem that he's a viable option. He's got no experience of governing or running really anything. But in terms of names that are actually out there that are saying that they want this, and he's actually been imploring the clerics not to appoint a new leader, to wait.
Wait for what? I mean, I think the clerics are over, you see. I think it's gone. I don't think the clerics...
Oh, I don't know about that. I
suspect they've had it. And that's why I'm saying I think the question now is, it is the hard men who've probably got a lot of blood on their hands too. I accept that. But you can't have a vacuum. That is a disaster.
Isn't Khamenei, though, the embodiment of the capacity of the Iranian state to combine those two things, the hard man, the military backing with the religious ideology and produce some, you know, this very particular form of a regime that has managed to hold such a stranglehold on power? Why would they? I don't understand how you are concluding that the mullahs are over.
Oh, well, to me it's obvious. I mean, I think they've run their course. That's what we've been reading. I mean, it's been 50 years, and that's quite a long time to sustain. I mean, they're revolutionaries, and they're revolutionaries of the sort of 80s and 90s. They couldn't adapt. That was the trouble. They were really stuck in the past, and then they became very corrupt. And I think the Iranian people are desperate for a modernisation, and that's not the clerics.
But that does not mean that that's what happens. That's the distinction I'm drawing. Like, you're making a persuasive argument as to why it's right for change, My question is, what is it about what's happened so far that indicates to you that that is actually where things are at?
And I guess my concern would be, I think we've seen a performance of strength from the Iranians in response to this. They didn't wait for a few days.
No, they didn't.
They've gone bigger and harder, and they've had more impact. They've been prepared to risk the response from the Gulf. And remember, only a few weeks ago, they were able to, persuade, or they were able to act en masse against civilians and kill tens of thousands of people. So that to me doesn't feel like a weak regime. That feels like a regime that still has within its reach the kind of levers of power.
No, it's a desperate regime, though. I mean, it reeked of desperation, of last gasp desperation. Didn't mean it wasn't shocking, and it was utterly, utterly shocking. But I think all the hallmarks of this is that stage of power. I'm not saying Hamish, it's tomorrow, but I think in terms of power shift, I think it. For me, it's pretty clear that they have reached the end of their tether. They'll have a few more, dare I say, scalps, which is why the decision-making inside that Revolutionary Guard Corps at the very top is so crucial at the moment and so dramatic.
Can we just zoom out for a moment, please? Because, it strikes me that this is kind of how far the world has come, that we're not even talking about this. No agreement from Congress for Trump to do this, use the term war. No support from the United Nations. No legal justification was made whatsoever. I read a really interesting piece from David Sanger in the New York Times, which detailed how the Americans had spoken to some of their European counterparts over the last few weeks, and the Brits had declined to allow the Americans to use Diego Garcia, which sits in the Indian Ocean, so directly below where all of this is taking place, as a launch pad for any of this, because the Brits saw there being no legal justification for this. Reports out of Iran of schoolgirls, school children killed next to one of the Revolutionary Guard bases that were attacked. I'm just seeing reports on the BBC at the moment as we're recording this saying that Khamenei's daughter and granddaughter were killed. I think it's something like 40 Iranian officials killed so far in the strikes. That's what CBS is reporting. And at the United Nations, the Iranians saying these are war crimes. The United States has stepped out and committed a series of war crimes.
This is Guterres saying there's still room for diplomacy. I did smile. Look, this is incredibly challenging for us all. It is about might, but there's a big play underway, and I don't exactly know how it's going to turn out, but I think. And Trump's press statement last night was truly extraordinary to watch that. It was just an amazing thing to sit through and hear him. I thought Trump sounded under an enormous amount of pressure, myself. The minute there are US casualties, which there will be, well...
He warned of that in that speech.
Yeah,
he said that there will be service people.
I know, but
I don't think Trump is doing anything that he doesn't want to do. I think this idea that he's kind of reluctantly going to war, I don't think so.
I don't think he enjoys this.
The Iranians did try to assassinate him, right?
I don't think he enjoys this.
It's not a question of whether or not he enjoys it. But, you can't line up that kind of military might in the Persian Gulf and not already be 80% toward a conflict. And that didn't happen overnight. That took weeks and weeks of planning. So I think this line that, it's the Israelis, the Israelis led the charge and the Americans came in behind them, I think this is all done with full knowledge and kind of mutual cooperation.
Well, I'll have to agree to differ, as I often do with Hamish.
I just think that there are different perspectives in this, right?
So we can definitely and there's a war. There is a war on. Mm. Thankfully, we are not. Penny Wong, our foreign minister, made that pretty plain. Mind you, she did have a couple of very interesting lines. I did think when she made her appearance this morning, a regime that has to murder its own people to maintain authority has no legitimacy. So that I thought was a pretty important statement of intent, as it were, or approach from the Australian government. And mercifully, you know, we're looking on. And I mean, I think the Gulf itself is going to be an extraordinary place to look at. I mean, obviously, residents of Doha and Dubai are shocked, rigid, that it's really come to them. And I don't know how the Saudis and the Emiratis are going to behave. They're obviously pretty shocked. They didn't actually think that the Iranians would unload on them.
They didn't want it to happen. Remember, they went to Trump and lobbied him to not do this. So now they're left with the impacts of it. And then what do they do? That's why I think the Iranians have targeted the Gulf states so heavily, is because perhaps they're looking for the Saudis and they're looking for the UAE and Qatar to go to Trump and say, whoa, let's try and pull this to some kind of a conclusion. Let's try and finish this off in some form or other so it doesn't spin on for weeks and weeks. But it'll be interesting to see what the Gulf states choose to do.
Yeah. Well, shall we wind it up there? We're going to keep covering this on Global Roaming throughout the week. Obviously, things are still unfolding. On Sunday, as we're recording this, there's going to be a lot more, I think, to emerge, including, you know, confirmation one way or another as to whether a body has been identified of the Supreme Leader, Khamenei. That we haven't seen that absolute confirmation just yet. The Americans and the Israelis intimating that they believe he's been killed, but I don't think there's been any really unequivocal evidence of that just at this stage. So anyway, you can find us on ABC Listen and catch us at 11 a.m. on Radio National and 9 p.m. weekdays. Kylie, Geraldine, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Later. Bye.